So, class is called Legends and Lessons. Legends for the person we're talking about, and lessons for the person's Torah that we'll be talking about. And typically how this class is going to work, the Legends and Lessons part at least, is it's going to be focused on someone whose yahrzeit is that Hebrew month. So, as we know, the month of Tammuz just began, and as you could imagine, we could have picked from a whole slew of legends of Jewish history. And today we're going to be talking about a man known as Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, his yahrzeit is the 4th of Tammuz. Anyone know what tonight's... Tonight is the 6th.
June 9th, 1171.
Well, don't check everything that I'm going to say. But tonight is the 6th, so his yahrzeit was on Sunday. Okay? Early yesterday. And oftentimes people don't necessarily know why he's called Rabbeinu Tam. There's actually not a consensus about it, so everyone's on the same page. But Rabbeinu Tam is perhaps the most well-known of the Tosafists. The Tosafists were, by and large, the grandchildren of Rashi, or the descendants of Rashi, I should say, none of whom were his sons. Why not? Because he only had daughters, right? So if someone ever says that they're a descendant of Rashi, you should know that it's not Ben Achor Ben. Right, it's not possible that anyone's the direct descendant of Rashi. It's through a mother, through multiple different avenues. Many Ashkenazic Jews are descendants of Rashi. It just happens to be that Ashkenazim share a similar genetic code that runs back to, you know, the French Jewry. But either way, so Rabbeinu Tam. What was Rabbeinu Tam's name? Without looking at the paper. Yeah, if you look, you're disqualified.
Tom?
His name was not Tommy. Right? So his name was Yaakov. So why was he known as Rabbeinu Tam?
Yaakov Ish Tam.
So that's the simplest, pardon the pun, the simplest way of understanding it. But the truth is, because he worked Rabbeinu Tam's villains. That's what he was known for. So first of all, so when was Rashi born? Rashi was born in 1040. He passed away in 1105. And as one of my rabbanim would say, the most influential 25 minutes of history, 1040 to 1105. But Rabbeinu Tam was born in about the year 1100, right? Because he's a grandson. So he's the son of a Rabbeinu Meir, Ben Shmuel, I believe. And Rabbeinu Meir was married to Rashi's eldest daughter, Yocheved. And Yocheved and Meir had 3 or 4 children. I'll explain that in a second. The oldest of whom was Shmuel. They named their son Shmuel. Shmuel ben Meir, also known as the Rashbam, right? The Rashbam was the oldest of Rashi's grandchildren, the Bechor of Yocheved. Welcome, Katzes. And the Rashbam was known more for his commentary on texts. In fact, the Rashbam was perhaps the one who had the closest relationship with Rashi as a grandson. Because if you put things together, as I just said, so the Rabbeinu Tam was born in 1100, and Rashi died in 1105. Right, most influential 25 minutes in history, 1105. So they only overlapped for 5 years. So Rabbeinu Tam never really learned from Rashi, right? We consider Rabbeinu Tam to be one of the most, if not the most, influential descendant of Rashi, but he really didn't even know him. It was a grandson who didn't know him because he passed away only 5 years into his life. The Rashbam, however, implies in a few different places, the Rashbam implies that he had many deep conversations with Rashi, to the extent that the Rashbam claims in one of his Perushim in Bereishis that he actually heard from his grandfather, from Rashi, that if Rashi would have written his Perush on Torah again, he would have written it simpler. We know that Rashi is known to be, or supposedly tried to be, the Pashtan, right? The one who could explain the psukim as simply as possible. The irony is that most of the time, Rashi is quoting Midrash, and is not just explaining the simplicity of the pasuk. But the Rashbam claims that his grandfather would have, if he had more time and if he had more abilities, he would have simplified his perushim, his explanations. It's known that towards the end of Rashi's life, for the last 10 years or so, his daughters actually wrote many of his tshuvas. Many of his explanations were written by his daughters, so Rashi was a little bit slower than he was in his earlier age, which is why there are many legends about Rashi's daughters. It's almost positive that they did not wear tefillin, but they were Talmidei Chachamim. They definitely were very, very knowledgeable, and they even helped write his tshuvas, not just by transcribing, but actually conversing with him. Yeah, Henry.
The ones that they translated, or the ones that they helped him do it, were they ever named in any of them?
I've never seen it. But the legend is that they were the ones that wrote it. But it's an interesting question. Maybe historians have more documents nowadays than they ever have, then they can find some kind of source for that. But
you called them Talmidei Chachamim.
Talmidot Chachamot. And so Rashbam was the firstborn, and then they had a son. His name was, I think I wrote it down. Oh no, Reb Yitzchak was the firstborn. Reb Yitzchak was the firstborn, but he actually passed away relatively young. They both did, the Rashbam and the Rivan. So Reb Yitzchak ben Meir was also the firstborn. There's a legend that there was a third son named Shlomo. Now, Shlomo should ring a bell because that was Rashi's name, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. So why was he named Shlomo? According to the legend, he was born after Rashi died. That, however, doesn't really make much sense because we know that the last son was Rabbeinu Tam. And as we said, Rabbeinu Tam was born in 1100. So it can't be that Shlomo, who was born before Rabbeinu Tam, was named after Rashi, who died if Rashi hadn't died yet, right, until 1105. Either way, there's a legend that there was a Shlomo, who was a grammarian, but it's really, it's not an easy thing to figure out.
How do we know so certainly that Rabbeinu Tam was the last one?
I don't know if we know it certainly. I just heard Rabbi Beryl Wine say that.
Might be that was the last one that was during Rashi's life.
That could be. It could be. We just don't have a lot of textual evidence of Rabbi Shlomo, the grandson. We don't really have much to say about him. But what's interesting is, if you remember, the firstborn's name was Rabbi Yitzchak. So what was his acronym? If you look at Tosfos, it's not the Re, it's a different person. His name was the Rev, he was known as the Revam. If you look at Tosfos, oftentimes, not so often, but he's known as the Rivam. What would Rabbeinu Tam's acronym would be? If his name is Yaakov. Also the Rivam. So he's almost forced to take another nickname. Right? His oldest brother's name was the Rivam. Or at least that's how we called him after he passed, at the very least. So then Rabbi Yaakov would have also been the Rivam. Which is why he couldn't go by the Rivam, because we get them all mixed up. Although there are some people that say there are some Rivams that are Rabbeinu Tam, but we'll leave it to the historians to figure that one out. So he's named Rabbeinu Tam, most likely because his name was Yaakov, Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He was the studious one. And from a very young age, obviously, like many of the Gedolim were, he was known to be a prodigy. And everyone knew that he was going to be something very special, to the extent Rav Beryl Wine says that some people called him Rabbeinu Tam to refrain or to prevent an Ayin Hara. What does that mean? They say, "Oh, your son, he's so brilliant," and Rav Meir would say, "No, he's just a Tam. He's a simple son. He didn't want to, you know, give an Ayin Hara and make him not as brilliant as he was." So some people say it's a testament to his brilliance that he was known as Rabbeinu Tam, which is an interesting svara. There's another possibility that it was based on one of the gezeras or takanas he made later on in life, based on a pasuk, but we won't get into it because it's a little complicated. So he was born around the year 1100, and as we said, Rashi passes away. His grandfather passed away around 1105. There's a legend that says that Rashi's daughter, Yocheved, started to cry when Rashi passed away. And Rabbeinu Tam, little Yaakov, he was little Yankel, he said to Yocheved, his mother, he said, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "Because the light of Israel has just passed away." And as the story goes, Yaakov says back to her, "I'm going to find the light and I'm going to kindle it again." And the story goes that he obviously becomes Rabbeinu Tam in much of the same way that Rashi was the leader of the Jewish people at that time. Rabbeinu Tam in his adult life became the unanimous Gadol Hador, at least for Ashkenazic Jewry. And there's an interesting history that happens, which is that if you think about Rashi's life, so when did Rashi pass away? 1105. What happens a little earlier than that around Ashkenazic Jewry, Michael?
The Crusades, the second one.
The Crusades, when was the first one?
1096.
1096. In which communities?
France, Germany, all.
So predominantly, the three main Ashkenazic communities, at least the Talmudic communities, are known as the Kehilot Shum. Anyone ever heard of that? Kehilot Shum? You've heard of it?
Yeah.
The three different communities. Shum is an acronym for spire, worms, or varms, and mites, right? So Shum is an acronym for those three communities, and they were the pillars of Ashkenazic Jewry. Rashi learned in the Beis Medrash of Worms, right? And when he goes to Worms, he becomes a Talmud, and there's legends about him giving in anonymous notes, and the Rebbe starts talking about his notes, and it ultimately becomes that Rashi's notes become what we know now as Parish Rashi, but what his grandchildren refer to as the Kuntres. What's a Kuntres?
Treatise.
A Kuntres is a treatise or a pamphlet. It's a series of notes. And his grandchildren call it the Kuntres. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that they knew it was their grandfather. But for Rashi's sake, who wanted it to be anonymous originally, they called it the Kuntres. Whoever made our Gemaras felt like everyone knows it's Rashi already, so they could put Rashi on it. But at least the Tosafists, the grandchildren of Rashi, called it the Kuntres. And at that time, if you think about the Crusades, so those communities were decimated. Right, Rashi had gotten out before the Crusades got there. Rashi was already in Champagne, in France, northern France. But all of his colleagues, think about all the other Rashis that could have been, all perished in these Crusades. The Beltei Medrash perished, and all the Sfarim were destroyed. And what happens in the aftermath of those communities being destroyed is that effectively the Ashkenazic Jewry are looking for a new headquarters. Where is going to be the new Beis Medrash everyone goes to? And soon enough, first of all, the Rashbam takes over Rashi's place in Troy, I think it was. And then sooner or later, Rabbeinu Tam comes along in the early 1120s, 1130s, and he creates a Beis Medrash in, I think it's called Rompro, or something like that. There are different ways of pronouncing it. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. But either way, the Rabbeinu Tam creates a yeshiva, effectively, and it's one of the first yeshivas that attracts Talmidim from all over. Because as I was saying before, the Kehilot Shum, Shpire, Varms, and Mines, were essentially the place where all the sort of rabbinic prodigies would come to learn. That became the Babylonia of the medieval Ashkenazic Jewry. And after they were destroyed, so everyone's looking around, where are we going to go to next? So they were going to Rashi, they were going then to Rashbam, but once Rabbeinu Tam starts his yeshiva in this place, everybody comes to him. Everybody comes to him. The Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, talks about how there were over 80 Talmidim, which nowadays maybe you laugh at, but 80 Talmidim from all across. He had people from Bohemia and Russia and France and Germany all coming, and Provence, I guess, is the same place, but they were all coming to Rabbeinu Tam's yeshiva. And most, if not all, of the Ashkenazic leadership that comes in the next century after Rabbeinu Tam comes as the students of Rabbeinu Tam. Because Rabbeinu Tam quickly surpasses his brothers and becomes the leader of the Jewish people in all of Ashkenazic Jewry. The Rabbeinu Tam actually has an interesting line where you get a feel for who he was, but also how he differed from his grandfather. Right, so Rashi, we said, gave over his style to the Rashbam. If anyone looks at the Rashbam's Parish on Chumash, so you notice pretty quickly that the Rashbam is trying to get to the literal understanding of the words, right? The very simplistic, literal understanding. Rabbeinu Tam, what does Rabbeinu Tam's Parish on Torah look like? Anyone ever see a Parish on Torah from Rabbeinu Tam? He doesn't have one. Why do Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi, doesn't have a Parish on Torah? Rashi wrote on every single book of Tanakh. Every single one. Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, wrote on everything. Rashi wrote a simple parish on the Gemara. And yet, Rabbeinu Tam, what does he write? Nothing simple. What does Rabbeinu Tam write? Predominantly, he's the main author of Tosfos. He's the main author of all the Tosafot commentaries that we find on the outer side of the Gemara. Rashi is on the inside, and the Tosafot are on the outside.
Weren't these commentaries destroyed by fire or something, and he had to rewrite them again? And
Rabbeinu Tam's.
Rashi. And then, will we have
Rashi's commentaries?
The third one? Or that's someone else?
It might be something else.
Maybe
the Ram was also pretty
protective.
The Gemaras weren't burned in Paris until the 1200s, so it wouldn't be that. They might have been destroyed or something.
He couldn't finish it also in the Gemara.
Rashi doesn't finish his parashah in the Gemara. Yeah.
Doesn't have Rashi.
It's the Rashbam. Yeah. There are different mesechtas that we don't have Rashi's parash either because he never wrote them or because we lost them. And they're usually filled in by the Rashbam, not Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam doesn't write Perushim. He doesn't write simplistic pshat. What does Rabbeinu Tam do? He approaches the Gemara as a science experiment. He looks at the Gemara and he says, here's a Gemara here in Chulin, but I know a Gemara in Sukkah that says something that sounds like they're at odds. And Rabbeinu Tam says, it must be that these two Gemaras are referring to different things. And then he tries to explain what the difference is. That's a very different approach to teaching Torah, right? So when Rabbeinu Tam comes and approaches his Torah learning, his Torah teaching, he's very different than Rashi. They were both the leaders of the Jewish people. Both the Gedolei Hador in their own right, but with completely different teaching methodologies. It's fascinating, you know, rabbis always talk about what's the most successful rabbi. You got to do this, you got to do that. But the truth is there are many different models of success, and we can learn that also from Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam.
Who was the Ramah from?
The Ramah is much later, Poland from the 16th century. Yeah, much later. Also Ashkenazic, but we're way before the Ramah right now. So if you look at the first source here, so this is a fascinating statement from, allegedly from Rabbeinu Tam. It's written by the Chida in a sefer called Shem HaGedolim. Shem HaGedolim is a historic sefer, talks about different Rabbanim and their lives in short. And by the really talking about Parish Rashi, this is not in the Rabbeinu Tam section, this is by Rashi's section, really in a sort of a footnote, he claims that Rabbeinu Tam said the following thing. V'haya Omer Rabbeinu Tam, Nechto, right, the grandson of Rashi, Masha Perish Adoni Zekeni, what my grandfather teaches, Hashas, when he gives a Perish on Shas, Afaniya Sezos, I'm also going to give a Perish on Shas. Not the same exact Perish on Shas, but a Perish on Shas. Aval Perish HaMikra, Leis Becheli Kilo Uchal Osohu. It's not in my strength to do that. That's not my strong suit. Now, this is way up open for interpretation. Some people explain, in the Shem Gedolim, when he says it, says that this is referring to the fact that Rashi, when he wrote his Perish, was Ke'ilu written with Ruach HaKodesh. He went to the mikveh before he wrote it. He had certain kavanos when he wrote it. That it was a very, very holy sefer, despite the fact that he's explaining the pshat of the words. And that's the meaning of what Rabbeinu Tam is saying here. It's certainly true that Rashi's parish on Chumash has become unanimously the go-to parish number one in day school throughout history. Right, the first Chumash was printed with Rashi. Right? There was a Bible, whatever, but you know, Chumash with Rashi was the standard of all Chumashim as early as the 1500s when they start printing them. And Rabbeinu Tam says, that's not my strong suit. That's not what I do. I don't do Chumash. It's an interesting phrase, right? I don't do Chumash. I only do Perishim and Shas. So there's an interesting Tosfos that might explain this. I forgot where I saw this. But the Gemara in Kedushin tells us that all of us have an obligation every single day to learn three different things. What are the three things that everyone has to learn? Mikra. That could be anything in Tanakh, not just Chumash, but Chumash is a good start. Tanakh. Right? Tanakh.
Mishnah.
And Talmud. Right? So what's the difference between Mishnah and Talmud? Mishnah back then in the times of the Gemara meant halacha. Right? If you look at a Mishnah, it's very shorthand, and it just tells you the conclusions. The Gemara comes along and tells you how to get there, right? Gives you back up the explanations. So the Gemara says, the statement is, if you still look in the source, lo tzrich liyomi. That's for the days. It's not exactly clear what the days means. Rashi says, perish bekuntris, so this would be an interesting base medrash if we had it. Yimei ha-shabbos. What is it referring to? It's the days of the week. Klomar. Shnei yamim mikra. For Sunday and Monday, you'll learn Tanakh. Shnei yamim mishnah. For Tuesday and Wednesday, you'll learn the Shulchan Aruch. Ushnei yamim gemara. And then for Thursday and Friday, you'll learn gemara. What do you do on Shabbos? I don't know. Just forgot a day. I guess that's when you do chazara. You learn all of them. And then says, v'lo nehira. Di'im kein, and he goes through a sort of a logical progression there. Akasi hava matzi l'mifrach miyada kam achaya. How do you know how long you're going to live? And therefore, you might be cutting it off in the middle. Maybe you're going to die on a Wednesday and you never got through that last set. That's what it sounds like that Tosfos is saying. V'nira li lefarish. B'chol yom v'yom atzmo. This is just the author of Tosfos, whoever it is. We don't know who it is. Every single day, yeshalish, you do all three. Al kein tikin b'seder of Amram Gon, or b'seder of Amram Gon, k'mosh anu noagim b'chol yom, kodem p'sug rizimra lomar mikra mishnu u'gemara. I spoke about this with the Mishnah Berurah guys last week at some point. This is why we have, the way we fulfill this is through Karbanos, is our mikra, and then we have Ezo Mukoman is the Mishnah, and then Rabbi Yishmael is Chazal, it's Gemara, it's a Medrash. That's how we would fulfill that. But comes Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, remember, Rabbeinu Tam is the one who said, I don't do Perushim on Chumash, it's not my thing. So what he said, Rabbeinu Tam Perush, She'anu somchim ahad ha'amrinim v'sanhedrin. Bavel, the word Bavel, the fact that we call it Talmud Bavli, Babylonia, the implication in that word is Belula. It's all mixed up. B'mikra, b'mishna, u'v'gemara. D'gamart Bavel, balol mikulam. That Gemara Bavel is full of everything. So how do the halachic decisors interpret this statement from Rabbeinu Tam? Just learn Gemara. If you open up a Gemara, what do you see? You see a pasuk. You see a Mishnah. And you see the discussion about that Mishnah. Says Rabbeinu Tam, you don't have to learn anything else. Just the Talmud Bavli. Just open up the Gemara. Let's get rid of all the other shelves. Let's just leave that shelf over there. All we have to learn is Gemara. Some yeshiva bachram don't like this, and they always struggle with it. But the Gemara really does have everything. It's the boilerplate of everything in Yiddishkeit. It has the Purushim on the Mikra, it has Purushim on the Mishnah, and it explains to us what the halacha is. And that's presumably, or potentially, the meaning of Rabbeinu Tam. When Rabbeinu Tam says, I don't do Chumash, what he means is, I focus on Gemara, and that's how I do Chumash. Right? They say that that when the Gra was older, when the Vilna Gaon was older, so how did he chazer his Gemara learning? He would open up a Torah. Right? He would just read the Pasuk. And when he reads the Pasuk, he thinks of all the Gemaras that he knows about that Pasuk. That's how he would chazer. So Rabbeinu Tam was the opposite. Right? He would open up the Gemara, and he would understand the Pesukim of the Torah. So that's Rabbeinu Tam. Obviously a very lofty level, but that's the explanation of who Rabbeinu Tam was. He knew Gemara cult. And through knowing it cold, he was able to develop his concept, his approach to understanding how to teach Torah, which is that you have a Gemara over here, you have a Gemara over there. They seem like they're not necessarily getting along. Let's figure out what the difference is, and that's how we'll come to a new understanding about what the Chazal were trying to tell us. And this is a fascinating approach because there were many people of that day that didn't like this approach, or that weren't necessarily using this approach. What was the other approach that people used? There was a man by the name of Rav Meshulam. I don't know where he was from. I think maybe Vienna. Rabbeinu Tam has some tshuvas, and he's fighting back and forth with this guy. This Rav Meshulam had a different approach. When he came to a Gemara, in one Gemara, let's say Moed Katan, it says X, and in Gemara Shabbos it says Y, they don't sound like they're getting along with each other. Let's change one of the words. That's what Rabbi Meshulam did. It must be a Girsa mistake. It must be that in the Shalshalas Hadoros, we lost the text. Someone misprinted it. Someone miswrote it. At that point, right, they had everyone doing it by hand. Someone must have wrote the wrong word. And Rabbi Meshulam would change the word. Rabbeinu Tam was Eish Lahava against this. This was the antithesis of Rabbeinu Tam. He never wanted to change any single word unless it was from a parish Kadmon, from someone like the Gaonim.
There was a whole thing on Talmud Bavli, on the Bavli,
yeah.
There were a lot of mistakes in there, a lot of things would change.
Hagos HaBach has a whole section where he'd mixed, but they're very minor, right? Yeah. This Reb Meshulam would literally change
Rabbi
the ideas.
Irons gave a whole shiur about that.
Who?
Rabbi Irons from the Kol.
Oh yeah? Okay, good. I'd like to hear it. But that's what Rabbeinu Tam was ish lahava against it. He always opposed this mentality, and that's why Tosfos are so important in order to make everything make sense. Because some people thought that we could just make it make sense by changing the text. Reina Tom said, no, we have to make it all work. And later in his life, he becomes really, for the better and for the worse, he becomes the rabbi who gets a lot of attention, right? The Gadol Hador, everyone's asking him questions from all over. And the center, as we said before, the center of Ashkenazic Jewry has now relocated from Germany to France. But that also comes at a price. He has relationships with some of the kings and the princes. We have interesting discussions between them. They ask, interestingly enough, they ask him questions on Bible. The kings ask him questions on Bible because he's the biggest rabbi. So we'll go to the biggest rabbi. Little do they know, he's not a Chumash guy, right? They didn't read. They didn't have the Shem Gedolim. They didn't have his take on it. And what is he supposed to do? Remember, what's in the back of his mind is all of his cousins who died in Kilochum in Germany. So he's not going to say to the king, sorry, you got the wrong guy. I'm not answering your questions. He's going to do what he has to do. And we have correspondence where he's going back and forth with the king of France, or the king of his municipality. I forgot what it was. And interestingly enough, he, in a few places apparently, I didn't go into the details too much, but he just uses Parash Rashi to explain all the questions to the guy. So he had someone to rely on. Maybe that's another reason he didn't do it, because he already had someone who did it. Right? Rashi told him how to explain things. But this also comes at a price. Because as you can imagine, when the biggest rabbinic personality lives in your nearby area, that also comes with threats. And in 1146, there's another crusade, and it comes into his home, and they take all of his stuff, and he was a wealthy man. You know, back then, I saw an interesting take on yeshivas back then meant that the Rosh Yeshiva supported the yeshiva, right? You didn't have big balabatim who were businessmen, you know, supporting the big rabbi. The big rabbi was the one with the business. That's why he was the big rabbi. He had the money, right? And Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, we know, you know, from Rashi Wine, had wine, and Rabbeinu Tam was also in the wine business, but he used that to support his real estate business, and he had a lending business. He had a whole bunch of different things, but when they came in 1146, they completely wiped him out. They took all of his stuff, to the extent that after they took all his stuff, they even dragged him outside to the curb, and they started to beat him up. They started to beat up Rabbeinu Tam. Legend has it that he got 5 knife wounds in his head in 1146. He's 46 years old. 5 knife wounds to the head, until one of his clients, one of the people that borrowed money from him, Rabbeinu Tam was always nice to him, he let him, you know, take a little longer to pay him back, came by just at the right time, and he convinces the crusaders, he convinces them that he's going to take care of him. Meaning not, he'd take care of him. He said that, I'm going to convert him to Christianity. That's what he says to them. Right, what's the difference? He dies, he's just like any other Jew then. But if you want, he's their rabbi. If you make him convert to Christianity, how good would that look? So he says, I'm going to convert him to Christianity. If he doesn't convert, come back to me in 2 days and I'll give him to you. And what is it? What happens? Not only does he allow Rabbeinu Tam to escape, but he and his whole family go with him. They all escape out of the country and they settle in Troy, which is where the Rashbam was. And they escape the death that was supposed to happen to Rabbeinu Tam, Baruch Hashem, because then he lives for another 25 years until 1171. And when he meets up with his brother, the Rashbam, they create this Beis Din together, they get all these different rabbis together, and they start making real important changes to help the Jewish people. There were different things that were going on, specifically in terms of marriages, in terms of making sure people got their ksubas or their dowries, but we'll leave the details out for a different time. But he basically joins up with the Rashbam, and the Rashbam only he passes away a few years later. But effectively, the headquarters of Rabbinic Judaism then go back to Troy, like they were with Rashi. And effectively, Rabbeinu Tam lives out his days. There was another crusade that he avoided in 1171. He passes away a little bit after that on June. What was it again, Michael? June 9th. I only remember because it's my anniversary. He passed away on June 9th, 1171, the 4th of Tammuz. I guess it was an early year. And now we celebrate his Arzad on the 4th of Tammuz. So that's really, that's the legend of who Rabbeinu Tam was. A few things that Rabbeinu Tam leaves us with. So first of all, obviously, open up any page of the Gemara, any page of the Talmud, and you'll find Rabbeinu Tam all over the place. Right? As long as it's a Gemara, and there's a Tosos on the page, Rabbeinu Tam is probably there.
He died June 9th.
That's what I said. Yeah, June 9th, 1171. And just a few really important halachos that maybe you didn't recognize came from Rabbeinu Tam. Specifically, and think about this for a second, if anyone here is friendly with Sephardim, you have close Sephardic friends? Okay, so maybe you'll recognize that some of the things I'm about to say, they don't do. Maybe you'll recognize. Because these are specifically halachos that Rabbeinu Tam produced for us that really differentiate Ashkenazic Jewry. Something I unfortunately skipped over was, remember that I said the Kehillot Shum, those major communities in Germany that were really the headquarters of Ashkenazic Talmudic scholarship, so those communities were really entrenched in their minhagim. And Rabbeinu Tam, because of his prowess, because of his scholarship, he was in some ways took liberties and innovations in his methodology to understanding Gemara. He took the conclusions of Gemaras in his own unique way, to such an extent that his students, when they learned from Rabbeinu Tam, never went back to those German communities, because they already had their minhagim and they weren't going to change. So what we find in Ashkenazi Jewry, and this is another reason why the headquarters moved away from those communities, is that all of his students go and spread Ashkenazic minhagim that we know today all over, in Russia and Bohemia and France and other places in Germany. And that's why the Ashkenazic Jewry is what it is today. So what are some of these famous psakim? So what are the things that we already know?
Kidneys.
Was he Kidneys? He could have been. I'd have to look at the Gemara Psakim again. It could be. I don't remember. But what's another one? Steve mentioned it before. It's Tefillin, right? I don't think Svardim wear Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. I'm not sure. Chabad does. They're Ashkenazic. And what are Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin? So typically we assume that Rashi Tefillin is the correct Tefillin. But those who want to be Machbid and also make sure, according to Rabbeinu Tam, that they're fulfilling tefillin. So they wear what's called Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, the middle two parshias, and the head tefillin. So there are four parshias in each one, Shema and Kol B'chor, they're different ones. And the first and the fourth are always the same, according to Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, but the middle two are switched. I don't remember which one's which. There's a legend that he spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu in a dream, and he discerned that this was the right thing, even though Moshe said it wasn't. Whatever. You can look up that story.
Wears both.
There are many people that try to wear both. There are many people that try to wear both. And okay, we'll talk about it a different time. But Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin, that's one. And then what's another thing? At the end of Shabbos?
No. When Shabbos ends.
When the Shabbos ends, Rabbeinu Tam was makvid to go by twilight. The 72 minutes of twilight. Right? Tzeis HaKochavim. So Rabbeinu Tam, 72 minutes. Some people are trying to be makbid for that. What about mezuzah? Anyone ever notice the difference between Ashkenazic and Sephardic mezuzahs? Ashkenazic mezuzahs are at an angle. And Sephardic mezuzahs are straight up. This is one of the great anomalies of halacha. That Rabbeinu Tam paskins that there's machlokas in the Gemara. Should it go flat or should it go upright? And Rabbeinu Tam paskin, we should put it in the middle.
When they swore him to Hagba.
Yeah. They have a completely different
Hagba. It's in a box. It's in a box. Yeah. It just stands up and they just turn the...
Right. I don't know if that's the same thing, but that's it's a beginning. There are a lot of differences between the Hagbas. But by mezuzah, so Sephard and Paskin, straight up. Rabbeinu Tam, for whatever reason, says, do it at an angle. On the... Going into the house, into the room, whatever you're going to, that's where...
The more important room.
Yeah. So that's another Rabbeinu Tam Shita that you might be familiar with. It's different from Ashkenazim and Sephardi. But perhaps the most significant one, although I'm not someone to actually make that claim, one of the major differences between Ashkenazic and Sephardic practice, specifically for women are allowed to make brachas on things they volunteer to do. Right? When you sit in a sukkah, women are allowed to say Leisheva Sukkah.
Doesn't want them to do that.
Right. Sephardim paskin that women can't volunteer. And this is a famous psak of Rabbeinu Thomas in a few different places all over Shas, that women are allowed to volunteer to say a bracha. What's the big problem with saying a bracha? What's the challenge? Because they say, asher kiddushanu v'mitzvosav v'tzivanu. Right? That you sanctified us and commanded us to do this mitzvah. So if it's a mitzvah that women are not commanded in, so how could they say that Hashem commanded us? Comes Rabbeinu Tam and says, no, they're allowed to, a whole bunch of different gemaras, and Pesachim and Rosh Hashanah, different gemaras that talk to that he explains to mean that women are allowed to say brachos. Perhaps the most fascinating gemara is a gemara in Kedushin that was Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef was the name of Namorah, and he was blind. Truth is that he had become blind. He didn't start off blind, so this might be a wrinkle. Tosos talks about this in Pesachim, but the Gemara says that Rabbi Yosef would have thrown a party. Why was he going to throw a party? Because the rabbis had said that those who are not obligated to say to do mitzvos and do them anyway are greater than those who are obligated to do mitzvos. Happens to be that he then learned that we pass them the other way. But for the time being, he was going to throw a party. Comes Rabbeinu Tam and says a fascinating diuk, a fascinating nuance from that Gemara. Could it possibly be that Rabbi Yosef was going to throw a party if he was able to do the mitzvahs but couldn't say brachas? That's his logic. It has to be that Rabbi Yosef was able to say brachas. Because if he wasn't able to say brachas, he would have never been so happy. If you can be so happy, it must mean you're saying brachas for the mitzvahs that you're doing. And being that he was blind, he wasn't obligated in many mitzvahs. Says Rabbeinu Tam, from here we know that women can say brachas too. Even if they're not obligated. Because Rabbi Yosef was so happy, he was throwing a party, it must be that he's able to say brachas. Fascinating diuk.
How is that different from a convert who wasn't commanded, because he wasn't Jewish? At the
time. Vitzivanu means that you commanded the Jews.
The Jews.
And he's Jewish. Now he's Jewish. Once he's a Jewish person, so he's part of those commandments.
And what if he's a Jewish woman? If he's a woman.
Yeah, so women are not obligated in certain things, right? So that would be the same question.
In this day and age.
So that's one of the... We'll talk about that tomorrow. Come to Mincha. So that's a few of the famous psakim of Rabbeinu Tam. Again, he doesn't have a parashat Chumash, so I can't give you a Devar Torah from the Parsha from Rabbeinu Tam because we don't have any. There is a parashat Chumash which is attributed to Tosfos. Some people like to say Rabbeinu Tam was involved. He probably wasn't, based on what we've been saying here, but also because we have texts of everything Rabbeinu Tam ever said and texts of other Tosfos that do say all those parashim. Either way, I wanted to bring one halacha that Rabbeinu Tam is also very important for. Happens to be also about women, maybe because Rashi's lineage, he was very sensitive to women. I don't know. He grew up in a household that was very reverent to women, many matriarchs. So there's an interesting dispute in the Gemara, at least the implication of a Gemara, about what does one do for fast days if they are nursing or pregnant, right? What do women do if they're nursing or pregnant for fast days? So typically, we always ask. That's what we do, right? You ask. That's right. You know that joke that the rabbi gets a new job and he comes to the first minyan or something, and I don't know, it's Chol Hamoed, and there's a question about what minhag they're going to daven, what are they going to daven, and everyone starts to fight. So they come to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, what do we do? And he says, I don't understand. This is a shul. It's been around for a long time. What's the minhag of the shul? Say, this is the minhag. We always fight about it. So when it comes to this, there are always different shitas, right? Always different shitas when it comes to women fasting if they have some kind of medical situation. So what our minhag is that you always ask the rabbi. No matter what the situation is, every situation is unique and you have to ask the rav. But all things being equal, let's say everything's equal. There's a woman who's pregnant or a woman who's nursing. Should they be fasting on a minor fast? Not on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, it's obviously a very unique situation, but all the other fasts, like Shiva Asar B'Tam is coming up next week. So the different shitas. Some shitas say they have to fast unless they're mamish, feeling sick. Some shitas say, no, they're not allowed to fast, because it's Safek B'Kuach Nefesh, you might be endangering the child, whether it's in utero or already a baby. You're endangering the child if you're not going to eat. Rabbeinu Tam is the middle, right? Much like the mezuzah, the compromise. Rabbeinu Tam says that if they're nursing or if they're pregnant, they're allowed to fast. They don't have to. If they feel uncomfortable, they don't have to. But they're allowed to if they want to, right? So he's not obligating them to. He's not obligating them not to. But he says in the sources 3 and 4, you find this. Rabbeinu Tam hiter le'ishi yoledes le'achol b'tzom gedalia shayashmini le'edasa. There's also even more so if it's her 8th month, and maybe it wouldn't be even that dangerous for... this has a lot of medical history to do with it, so we're not going to get into it. But the 8th month, assuming that at, even at the time of Hagos Ma'amuna Rabbeinu Tam, it wasn't as dangerous as the Gemara thought it was. So he says, even in the 8th month, she's allowed to not fast.
So, but the way you said it, it sounded like you said,
hitir
le'achol. Yeah,
hitir. Hitir. Not mechayev le'achol.
No, but hitir le'achol would seem that she should fast, but she's allowed to...
Allowed to eat. She's allowed to eat.
Right, right. But
so the, if
allowed to fast is a different statement. In other words,
well, it's both. Yeah, it's allowed to eat and allowed to fast. Whatever the woman's feeling up to. That's basically what he's saying. Ve'afagav damrin perek mefan alachra zayin yom im amr eni tzricha ein mechal and alas haShabbos. So a whole different thing about being docha Shabbos. Ve'lachim mutz damrin perek kama derabi derashana karele tzom karele. Sason ad ratzu misanin ratzu and misanin. If they want to, they can fast. If they don't want to, they don't have to fast. Lokach rishus umutzer lo lechol. Therefore, it's voluntary, and they're allowed to eat. And then the Hagos Mamoni explains that he's also referring to every situation, not just some gedalia, and not just pregnant women, but also nursing women. And he says this would not apply to Tisha B'Av, but at least for the minor fasts. And this is how we passing in the Shulchan Aruch, Hilchos Shulchan Aruch, right? Because again, Rabbeinu Tam is not necessarily going to be coming up in the Shulchan Aruch, right? Rabbeinu Tam is Ashkenazic. The Shulchan Aruch is predominantly Sephardic. So it's not necessarily the case that Rabbi Yosef Kara is going to follow Rabbeinu Tam, which is why Sephardim predominantly follow the Shulchan Aruch. And they leave the Ashkenazic Pesach to the Ramah. And here you find, HaKol Chayim L'Sanos Arba Tumas Halalu Vasu L'Frotz Keder. Comes the Ramah, and the Ramah adds, because he's the Ashkenazic parish, right? 400 years later, Ubaros Haminikos Shmistaros Harbe Ein Lisanos. If they're in a lot, in, if they're uncomfortable, they're very uncomfortable, so they're not supposed to fast. Va'afilu Einu Mistaros. And even if they're not so uncomfortable, Einan Michuyavos Lisanos. You don't even have to if they don't want to. Elishenagu Ech V'Hachmer V'Daku V'Zimus. Right. So some people, if they want to, they can be machmer on themselves, but they're not obligated. A strict letter of the law. Yeah.
How does a rabbi who's not a doctor, I'm not talking about the Rambam.
Because he spoke to doctors.
The doctor, how does he paskin halacha based on the doctors who are around in his day, knowing that the doctors in the next generation who is not paskin from the Torah.
So what's he supposed to do?
He should say, ask the doctor.
He did ask the doctor.
No. The woman who lives 200 years later, who's wants.
Well, how is he supposed to tell them what the doctor is going to say?
No, the halacha is go to the doctor in your generation, see what he thinks.
You go to the rabbi who can interpret what the doctor is saying and apply it to halacha. You have to have a rabbi that.
Which is what we do now.
He said, some say you're not allowed to fast on.
Yeah, and these halachas have also developed over time. And every single generation is different. But you can't just say go to a doctor because the doctor doesn't know the halacha part.
We don't want him to know. We want to know his medical opinion.
But
we'll decide.
The medical opinion has to be taken into account when the rabbi decides what's going on. You can't just... So you always have to have both the expert and the rabbi's opinion. And when it came to Rabbeinu Tam, so he was the one to go to for whatever situation there was, because he was the Gadol Ador. Rabbis went to Rabbeinu Tam to understand what they should be doing. And that's a little bit about the life and the Torah of Rabbeinu Tam, 1100 to 1171. Rabbi Yaakov Ember, the grandson of Rashi. That's a little bit of his life and a little bit of his legacy. Thanks for coming. We'll continue this type of shiur in a month from now at the beginning of Av. But next week we'll be doing Mishle with modern psychology. See what Shlomo Melech got right and what maybe we think differently of nowadays. Next week? The next Gadol? If you look through all of them on Av and you have a suggestion, you let me know. I don't know off the top of my head. We'll have plenty of other ones, trust me. Plenty of other ones. Yeah, Baruch Hashem. I know, I was going to say that.